Welcome, dear listeners and friends of the Soundologia platform. Thank you for joining us today. This is episode number 12 of the Soundologia podcast, and I'm your host, Peđa Kovačević. We will discuss experimental art and music and play some sounds brought by my guests to create an enjoyable time for you. A special shout out to all our new listeners who are tuning in for the first time. We encourage you to explore our previous episodes, where we have curated a diverse range of music genres by featuring talented sound and multidisciplinary artists who excel in experimental sound art. Today, I'm thrilled to introduce one of the leading multidisciplinary artists who has made significant contributions to various creative fields such as graphic design, cinematography, and sound art. Not only that, but he has also played a pivotal role within the experimental music community through his label Noir Age, which has already released over 60 albums. Please give a warm welcome to our friend Richard Verges, who I brought to discuss his professional path as a graphic designer, sound artist, performer, and the founder of a music label which has been releasing ambient and raw sound for years. Before we dive into our conversation with Richard, let me share some highlights from his impressive bio. Richard Verges is a Cuban-American artist who specializes in mixed media collage and sound art. He was born in Philadelphia and has lived and worked in New York as a member of the Brooklyn College Collective. Currently, he resides and works in South Florida. Verges' artistic style is influenced by his background in graphic design and audiovisual composition, which is evident in his handmade collage work on paper and mixed media experiments. His artwork has been exhibited in various cities, including Brooklyn, London, Chicago, Miami, Sydney, and Los Angeles. Additionally, Verges' collage illustrations have been published in reputable publications such as The New York Times, The Guardian, and The Atlantic. In 2017, he founded The Noir Age, which has released music by artists from around the world on cassette and vinyl in limited editions. The artwork is mostly handmade. Currently, he's recording and performing solo under the name Night Foundation. Recently, he released a collaborative record with experimental vocalist Little Annie. He has been commissioned to create and perform live scores for silent films such as Nosferatu, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and 1963 slasher film Blood Feast. Richard, welcome to the show. I'm glad we can finally meet and have a conversation.
Yeah, same, Peđa. Thank you for having me. And it's interesting to hear that artist bio read, where it's usually something that's, you know, it's weird when you're faced with your own work, you know, in somebody else's speech. So thank you.
I am always happy to bring artists who wear multiple hats like you, being involved not only in music, but primarily working within interdisciplinary media like you have been doing for years. And I know that it's going to be a great show, especially you provided all those video materials, documentation from your previous exhibitions, some of beautiful releases available at Bandcamp. And I value the way and the work that you have been doing for years in this old-fashioned analog style, creating cassettes and vinyls, as I'm a collectioner and I started playing records 20 years ago, and I'm still a big fan of vinyls. And just to give you all a heads up, I made the deliberate choice to play one of the captivating albums from Noir Age in the background during our conversation. Later, we will discuss this album and provide you with a special surprise. Let's start this conversation with something that happened to you recently. So, Richard, with your extensive community of followers and support for the NoirAge label, many people are already aware of the recent loss you experienced.
Yes.
This heartbreaking event led us to postpone our conversation, but you shared a post about how your sister influenced your musical and artistic taste. Given this, I would like to give you the opportunity to express yourself and release your feelings, as there are a lot of people who have gone through a similar loss of their closest family members and who might be listening to this.
Yeah, so as you had mentioned, I lost my sister 2 weeks ago. It was a fairly quick process of an illness that she had. What I'm left with are memories, and that's all you can really go back to with somebody who very much was pivotal in my life as far as creating a listening experience. And so, you know, early on as a child, you see stuff on TV, you hear stuff on the radio, and you kind of pick and choose the sounds, you know, maybe that you're attracted to. At early age, she's 10 years older than me, so she was very much into music growing up, and it was the era of the CD, so she was, you know, she had vinyl, but it was, the CD had just come out, so, you know, this is early 90s, I was, you know, old enough to kind of realize, you know, whatever they were showing on MTV was Michael Jackson, or it was pop music, this wasn't what I was into. She introduced me to a darker kind of world of music, and I'd say the kind of the jumping off point and an important artist for me was Nine Inch Nails. And through the music of Nine Inch Nails, I remember, you know, vividly sitting in her room and she was playing this new CD that she had just gotten, and she was playing it really loud, and there was just something in there that spoke to me and stayed with me. And through the introduction of that band by my sister led me then to explore different kinds of music that influenced Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails, which was industrial music from the UK. And you know, back then I didn't even know it, but this was the first time I was hearing producers like Adrian Sherwood and John Fryer, who, you know, was a big producer with the 4AD label. So I was, you know, I was hearing all this stuff innocently, and it was ingraining itself in my DNA subconsciously. And that led me then to, you know, more experimental forms of music and really just kind of keeping up with what she was listening to, also what my middle sister was listening to. So it was very much a familiar type of process and a very organic analog type of process. And that, I feel like, she was the impetus for my love of music. So I'm, you know, I'm very grateful for that. And really, that's kind of what I've been just going back to, you know, a lot of music that she used to listen to that resonated with me, and just kind of, I guess trying to make sense of everything through music, you know, kind of putting the puzzle together. So I'm grateful for her.
Let's start from your background as a multidisciplinary artist who incorporates different art forms and media like design, cinematography, collage, and sound art. So tell us about your background and how you discovered mixed media art, how sound art has become a significant form of expression in your work.
So my background is graphic design. That's what I have my degree in. My extracurricular activities then started to become working with sound and working with mixed media to kind of get away from the rigidness and the kind of, I guess, corporate feel of what graphic design can be, where it's something that I understand was something that I needed to make a living, to pay the bills. When I got into music, my promise to myself was to never compromise my integrity in that sense, to never, you
Amazing.
Know, to use music as an outlet for, you know, my profession, and then to use a mixed media collage, especially as an outlet for my profession. So I want to say 2010 was when I really jumped into mixed media collage. I took on the challenge of making one piece of art a day for the whole year. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a way for me to, you know, after my day job, to go home and work on a little something for myself, a personal project. Mm-hmm. And a few years before that is when I had started working on music. And it was very parallel process. And I could trace that back to university when I was at FAU. I took a class called Art and Music, and it was basically a class that was for visual arts students to introduce them to music. And I had a great professor. His name was David Courtney. He introduced us to John Adams. He introduced us to Morton Subotnick. He introduced us to Stockhausen, to John Cage. So it was like, wow, here's this world of art in the sounds that I had no idea existed. And mm-hmm. that led me to then start doing research on my own. And I remember actually specifically, and it was one of the books that I had listed in your questionnaire, which was a book called Noise, Water, Meat.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. By Douglas Kahn. That was a very important book for me. And I remember going to the FAU library and going to the very, very top floor of the library, all the way in the back. And that's where they had all the books on Fluxus, on Actionism, on sound art. And that's where this book just jumped out to me. It had this big title on the spine that said Noise, Water, Meat. I said, what is this? And I lived inside that book for the next few months, and I learned about John Cage, and I learned about William Burroughs. I learned about, sound as art. It blew my mind, you know, and I still feel like go back to it, and there's still so many morsels to still kind of process, especially at this stage in my kind of listening and creation point of my life.
Beautiful.
So very much that class, reading that book. So, you know, FAU isn't quite known for its arts. It's known for its football team. And, you know, in a way, I've always kind of felt a sense of revolt in a way. I guess there's kind of a punk aspect of myself that wants to kind of explore this part of the world that isn't so conventional, I guess. So that's initially what led me to working in experimental sound and experimental art. And in that class, Art and Music, the final project was we all had to create a piece of music. So we each got into groups, and the group I was in, I wasn't really feeling it at all. There was like a girl with a rain stick, and some other guy was like banging on maracas, and I'm like, this isn't me. And I had just started experimenting with tapes, with tape loops. I was making cassette tape loops. Mm-hmm. And after, you know, I went up there with the group when we did our stupid little song, I stayed there with a synthesizer and a tape machine and did my first musical performance in front of my class in my university at FAU. And it felt like a good moment. And it felt like this is something that I want to further explore and, you know, keep at doing. So that was kind of that planted the seed, yeah.
Beautiful. And I love that you mentioned like you didn't want to compromise your work, daily work, with something that you're doing aside, and that is the part of experimental non-commercial art. What do you think about musicians, professional musicians who create commercial music to earn, to pay bills, but they also put their hands on the experimental, non-commercial music?
Sure. No, I totally understand that. And I have immense respect for people that, you know, do commercial music, but then are experimental musicians. For instance, Suzanne Ciani, who created the Pepsi with her, I don't know how she created it with a bukla or whatever, but she created that sound of the Pepsi can opening. But she's an amazing synthesis and experimental musician. Or Brian Eno, who created the Windows welcome sound. You know, I think that's beautiful that he can do something like that and still be uncompromising in the true work that he creates, the pure music that he creates. So I definitely have respect. Yeah, and people interpret things differently. I guess the struggle here is having it not be misinterpreted, because sometimes things are misinterpreted and people think, okay, I'm doing this for a violent reason or for a derogatory reason or for something that has a negative effect. And music should be something that's pleasurable, that's creative. So it's just, I mean, the influx of information that we constantly ingest every day, it's hard to keep up with. Future shock. I've been reading a lot about future shock recently and kind of what, you know, we were predicting back, you know, in the 80s when that book came out. And we're living kind of in that era now where we're so inundated with technology and sound and visuals. And it's just, it's how we choose to interpret it. I think that's important as listeners and as humans, really. Yeah.
I agree 100%. And I will leave the conversation on the future shock for a little later when we speak about the concept of dystopia in your work. But let's touch upon some of significant research and aesthetic approaches that can enhance our understanding of the 21st century listening experience. How do audio and visual components influence us? And how do you incorporate them into your own artistic practice?
So starting from a visual world, a visual perspective, I then through that got into sound. I felt like I was working very much parallel in the way that I was constructing visual piece and the sound pieces. So it comes from a physical place, a material place, a very tangible place where I was visually starting with source material from old books and magazines and kind of using those almost as visual samples. And then as a parallel, working with sound, taking bits and pieces of dialogue from film, you know, household sounds, you know, snippets from other pre-recorded sounds that were already on the tape, and cutting those down and creating these little moments that tell stories. So I feel that the audio and the visual very much inform each other. And just through experimentation, then I kind of got into, well, how can I combine these two elements together? And that then got me to gravitate towards video art. So I was taking these collage elements and then now they're moving. And then now there's music set to these moving elements that are telling a story, but not telling the whole story. And I feel something that's very important for me is to leave things open-ended and not give everything away all at once. And that comes from David Lynch. David Lynch is a huge influence on me. Film is a huge influence on me. So it's that idea of let the audience interpret it how they want. Let them connect with it how they want. You know, this is, I want to create work for the common person. I don't want something to be over somebody's head. You know, I definitely respect virtuosity as far as, you know, art in arts, in music. Mm-hmm. But for me, what's most important with me is choice making and organization and how that resonates with an audience. Because first and foremost, I create the work for myself. But, you know, there needs to be an audience. And that's just as important, I feel.
Yeah, I feel that way too. The communication is very important. And as a curator and someone who writes about music, I always try to locate a communication within or inside of the piece, mm-hmm. either through the context when the piece was created, or the new way of interpretation and reception of the piece, like if the piece was written a long time ago, or either through some techniques and technology that stands behind the piece that composer used, and that can be interpreted through the devices or special compositional techniques.
Or be even part of the piece, like in John Cage's 433, exactly. Where right. The audience all of a sudden is the performer. And, you know, I like those kinds of flips where, you know, something is interactive in a way, and finding a way to include the audience. I feel that the days of being confrontational in music are over. Mm-hmm. I respect those times, you know, the early days of industrial music with bands like Throbbing Gristle and SPK. But that's provocation, provocative, you know, confrontation. And that's not what I'm into. I feel like you could be provocative in different ways that don't involve volume and violence.
Right. And when you were talking about the provocation in arts, I thought of the Fluxus movement that I know influenced your work tremendously. But also there was the movement from the beginning of 20th century expressionism. Some projects that you have done are related to expressionism. But let's dive now into the Noir Age label.
Okay.
So as an artist, performer, and someone deeply involved in the music industry through your label, let's discuss the steps you took from the beginning of your journey in founding the label. And how did you come up with the idea to establish and manage the label?
Yeah, so Noir Age was something that almost kind of just happened by accident in a way. It was 2017. A colleague of mine, David Brisky, we've been playing experimental music in the local scene for a while. He's more of a drone-based musician. He plays bowed guitar and synths and tapes. Mm-hmm. And we were playing a show, and we wanted to have a cassette to sell of our music at the show. We were playing at a gallery, this place called Space Mountain Gallery in Miami. And, you know, he said, oh, I've got like 10 blank tapes. And, you know, we had done this recording a few months back. And he's like, I'm going to, you know, I'll dub them. You do the artwork and we'll have a tape to sell at the show. And we did, and it was an edition of, I think, 10 or maybe like 12, and we each kept a copy. And the name Noir Age comes kind of from a place of new age, but like a darker new age. So kind of poking fun at the new age genre with kind of a dark tinge to it, and also kind of incorporating film noir and just a dark age, I feel, that we're in. So it just kind of came together, and the logo and everything, it was just kind of, sometimes the best ideas are the ones that come quickly.
Yeah.
So then I said, okay, well, we've got this tape, I've got this name for a label, and then it started, I was doing art zines, so I was doing collage zines, and then I said, well, why don't I keep releasing music? And the release after that was called Transplants, and it was a score for a dance piece that I had composed with my colleague Anna Mendez, who I'd been working with on music for a while. As her, she's a choreographer, and anytime she would do a dance piece, she would come to me and I would do the score. And a lot of times it was a kind of an improvised thing. Mm-hmm. So then the second release was a score to this dance piece. And then my next step from there was, who are other experimental music artists that are local? Mm-hmm. And then from there I thought, well, why do I have to keep it to a local kind of dynamic where I have access to artists all across the world through Bandcamp, through SoundCloud. So I started, you know, I'm always listening. And one of the releases after that, it was my first international release. and it was with an artist named Gafael, and he's based in Wales. Mm-hmm. And it was just something I heard one night. I was on SoundCloud, and this album was playing, and it was beautiful, and drone bass with some kind of modern classical touches to it, and even a little bit of industrial. And, you know, I reached out to him and I said, hey, I'd like to release your music. I just started this label. You know, I've only got a few releases. And, you know, he was happy to work with me on that. And that's kind of, I feel like that was the first release that really got the label moving as far as reaching out to artists and curating a certain kind of sound for the label.
Amazing. What are some of the most captivating and demanding moments you've encountered throughout the years with Noir H?
I guess doing vinyl for the first time, just because it was a big leap to spend that amount of money and kind of, you know, wait the time that it does, because the vinyl pressing plants are crazy now. So this was like about a year for me to get this record. It was in 2020. I had taken out a small business loan to fund the record. And it was a record of my own music. I thought, you know, if I'm taking the chance here with vinyl, it's going to be something that, you know, I have my hands fully, yeah, it's fully my vision. And it was a good learning experience getting it mastered, packaging it. So I did, it was all hand packaged. My friend Ingrid at IS Projects, she runs a letterpress shop. So I did letterpress, I did silkscreen. Music packaging has always been such an important thing. Mm-hmm. And I go back to, you know, those albums on the 4AD label. One of my favorite groups is a group called Soviet France. Mm-hmm. And all their early records in the 80s were all packaged in different ones, in a burlap sack, another one was in roofing shingle. So this kind of very DIY approach to, you know, that this record that you're listening to, or this tape that you're listening to, I touched and I folded and I packaged.
Right.
And I love that human connection of it just being organic and feeling like you're connecting with the person who's creating and packaging and releasing the music.
Right.
So that was definitely, it was a difficult plunge, but it was a very satisfying experience. And then that led me to do two more records. So after that, I did 7-inch, which was a band that I had when I was in New York, my friend Alex, called Mother Sky, and that's a little bit more post-punk style. And then mm-hmm. my most recent one, which was with Little Annie, who is a legend, who lives down here. She's collaborated with numerous, numerous artists in the underground scene that I very much admire. So it was for that, that was a huge moment for me to be able to work with somebody of that caliber and put out a piece of art, a piece of music. And I think one of the parts of the question is like one of the most challenging.
Yeah, demanding moments.
Demanding. So there was a moment, we got to open for Tangerine Dream last year.
Okay.
And, you know, we showed up early for the sound check. You know, I had all my synths with me, and, you know, she had, it was going to be kind of a half and half set where I would start off the set and then she joined me at the end of the set for two vocal songs. It was the first set for Tangerine Dream in the United States of their first tour. So this was like a big one for them. I was up for my sound check. Tangerine Dream, when I got to the venue with Annie, Tangerine Dream were sound checking and they were running over, and it was just, mm-hmm. they had, if you can imagine the type of gear that Tangerine Dream uses live.
Right.
So it was a little intimidating, and, you know, I get up there with, I had a Casio, I had a DX7, and I forget what else I had there, ARP Odyssey, and, you know, all my wires and all my kind of, I always kind of felt like an amateur, but I'm proud of it. I'm proud of that kind of DIY-ness. So it was time for my sound check, and there was a hum, and it was the sound team, the sound engineers that were on tour with Tangerine Dream, not the sound engineers at the Miami Bandshell. Yeah. So these guys were tough, and there was a hum, and they needed to get rid of this hum. At some point, one of the German guys turns to me, and he says, in a low voice, he says, I don't know, you might have to make an executive decision. And I said, oh, I said, what does that mean? Like, not play or scale down my gear? Or they ended up changing out maybe three different DI boxes. Mm-hmm. they finally got rid of the hum and we were ready to go. But that was one of the most difficult things. And I guess that was, yeah, performing. And also, you know, because I was, you know, I was out there with my label mate and we were going to perform. And so yeah, there's been a lot of ups and downs. But for the most part, it's been great experiences working with all the different artists and making new friends. You know, I sure. love the fact that you could connect with people just through music and find these people on other sides of the world. Like I told you, I released an artist from Belgrade, Zeb Pekarin, and she's an amazing artist.
I was delighted to discover that one of the musicians whose music was released under NoRH happened to be one of the talented female artists from my homeland, Serbia.
Yeah, so, you know, that was a great process and, you know, we still keep in touch. And, you know, as overwhelming and as annoying as social media can be sometimes, it's a good connection. It's a good force to connect with like-minded people that are working on, you know, similar projects and similar art. So I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, and it's so wonderful that people and musicians can connect today and work on the same projects from different parts of the world. And I love the idea of having the handmade vinyl sleeve design received directly from the artist who hand it over to the customers and the audience. So that's the beauty of belonging to this tiny niche experimental music community.
Yeah, I mean, like with anything you want to obviously be successful and move to a higher level as far as production. I mean, up until now, my tape runs are 50 and I feel like 50 is kind of a good amount where I can sell them and I can make a little bit of profit and split that little bit of profit with the artist.
Are you talking about the number of vinyls or
my deal with the artist has always been after cost is recouped for production, mm-hmm. whatever profit it is, I split that 50-50 with the artist. Sometimes artists say, I don't want the money. I'm glad to just have a release. And I mean, that money ends up going to the next release anyway. So it's a very organic kind of democratic way sure. of, I guess, doing it. Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned the small loan that you took, was it paid off after that? Or, were you in some type of bankruptcy?
I'm paying it back now. Everybody thought in 2020 that these small business loans were going to be forgiven and they weren't forgiven. So I'm paying it back. It's not a big deal, but I'm glad that I did it because I was able to put out that record and it's something that's very much a milestone for the label. So yeah.
Okay. Let's move on to one of your live scores that you created for silent movies. The first one is Nosferatu and you provided the documentation. Tell me about your experience working on live scores for silent movies, specifically in the horror genre. And I had a chance to see what's the score like. So what all those elements and symbols like?
That was like a small score for a durational dance sound piece. So the fingerprints each represented the three performers in the piece. And then there was different symbols for different sounds that were triggered by movements.
Okay.
That was kind of my first hand at actually writing some type of a score that was a graphic score for sound, which I later in 2022, I took a workshop with Raven Chacon, who specializes in graphic scores. So this was a workshop at the ICA. It was for a week, and it focused on graphic scores for music composition. And I learned a lot through that and realized even too, I had kind of done that with that original score. As far as the scores for the silent films, that's just me kind of making audio notes, making, you know, written notes of, okay, I want to bring in this instrument here for this scene to kind of create attention, or I want to bring in this loop, or, you know, but for the most part, I play it all live and improvise, as I like to do, as that's my favorite way to kind of play music. And why the horror genre, you ask, I guess.
Yes.
That's just one of those movies that's been a staple as far as a live scoring, because it's public domain. And it lends itself to this kind of genre of music that we've come to know as cinematic, as soundtrack. And Nosferatu has a lot of those kind of cinematic moments that lend themselves to a certain kind of music. And my first hand at the Nosferatu score was at the Gables Cinema, and that was, I want to say, 2016, maybe. And I was approached by a group that was doing shows down here called Miami Music Club, and they were putting on experimental music shows. And David, one of the members of the group, reached out to me and said, he's a film guy, that's his background, is film. He reached out to me and he said, you know, we have this opportunity to show Nosferatu, would you want to do the music? And I said, what, like, why'd you come to me? And he's like, because I've heard your music and I just feel like it fits. You know, I've always come from kind of what I was telling you, a darker side of music, you know, coming from stuff like Nine Inch Nails or Throbbing Gristle or Coil. So I've always felt kind of, I don't know, an attraction to that, to the poems of Edgar Allan Poe, to the films of David Lynch. So that kind of got me to do my first live score. And then from there, I did Nosferatu again. I did Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. I did that Blood Feast, that Slat, supposedly the first slasher film. I even did a Yiddish film at some point from the 1920s. And that was a big challenge because, you know, I had been scoring all these kind of movies from the horror genre. And then here's this kind of, it's a Yiddish silent drama. And it was called Broken Barriers. And that was showcased at the Betsy Hotel.
Oh, really?
And that was a big, big accomplishment for myself, just because it showed me that I wasn't just limited to doing live scores for horror movies, that I could do different genres and have it be successful. So I was very proud of that one.
Was the movie about the Holocaust?
Or? No, it was like a girl who wants to get married and her father doesn't want her to get married, and very just kind of simplistic storyline, very just a basic kind of movie, but in the way that music can elevate cinema is so interesting, you know, where, I mean, I feel like the score to a film is just as important as the visuals sometimes, because it tells a narrative and it makes you feel emotion.
I'll be honest, that was my first time to see the score for the silent movie, because when I ask you to provide some scores, you ask me if I was looking for cinema or movie scores, and I was a little bit confused. They said, okay, send me whatever you have. And I think that there are not so many people who had a chance to see what the sound or movie score liked. So I'll definitely put it in the episode description so people can see. And I did the research, and there are a number of festivals that project those old silent movies with the musicians and artists who perform sound live.
Yeah, like Metropolis is one that I want to do at some point. And the last few scores I've done was through a film festival called Popcorn Frights. That is a horror movie festival that's local. Mm-hmm. This guy Igor runs it. And he, at some point, wanted to remove the audio from Eraserhead and have me do Eraserhead. It turned out he couldn't get the rights to show the movie in that way, so it never happened. But then I ended up doing that movie Blood Feast, which was a combination of dialogue that was still in the film, and then he was able to remove most of the like score that was in the film, and then I created my own score to that movie. So that was quite a challenge as well, but a fun experience.
Just to remind our listeners, they are listening to episode 12 on the Soundologia podcast, and I have a pleasure to speak with Richard Verges, a multidisciplinary artist and founder of Noir Age Music Label. Let's now move on to the expressionism in cinematography. I have to say that I also learned new things while doing research on those movies that you were engaged and that you made the sound and sound scores. So how did you get into the cinematography of expressionism?
I'd like to say, I mean, from the age that I am and the way that I you know, ingested culture at an early age. I want to say it goes back to the movie Beetlejuice, where there's a lot of elements of expressionism. You see a lot of, you know, scenes in Beetlejuice where, wow, that was done in Dr. Caligari in the 20s. So that was kind of, you know, in a way, a pop movie, but my gateway to, you know, something a little bit different, something a little bit more rich in history. And then that got me into, yeah, to research expressionism, to research Dada art, surrealist art, Bauhaus school. I feel like what the Bauhaus school was doing was very aligned with just this aesthetic, which it was, you know, dealing with abstract structures and lines, but then also it was, I feel, one of the first instances of what became intermedia art, mm-hmm. where you had somebody like Laszlo Moholy-Nagy, who was making a collage. He was photographing the collage, and then he was taking that photograph of the collage and making another collage. And then he was filming those collages. He was making those collages move. And just this combination of all of these kind of different art forms just really spoke to me. And Laszlo Moholy-Nagy is definitely one of my favorites and a huge inspiration. And just to see kind of how ahead of the times that these people were at that age, like in that era, is very interesting to me. And just something that I feel aesthetically appealing. You know, I see certain films and there's just something about them. They might not have a story or make sense, but there's just, I love visual storytelling.
Just to let our listeners know, they had the opportunity to hear some parts of the original track that Richard composed for the silent movie Nosferatu.
Yes.
I suggest now we listen to the song or the track from Richard's album. This is the face that we show the world. It is under his name, Night Foundation, and the track Activity of Sound. And I think we have a plenty of stories to touch upon because you will hear the voice of one of the most famous composers who shaped the experimental music scene.
When I hear what we call music, it seems to me that someone is talking, and talking about his feelings or about his ideas of relationships. But when I hear traffic, the sound of traffic here on 6th Avenue, for instance, I don't have the feeling that anyone is talking. I have the feeling that sound is acting. And I love the activity of sound. What it does is it gets louder and quieter, and it gets higher and lower, and it gets longer and shorter. It does all those things which I'm completely satisfied with that. I don't need sound to talk to me. We don't see much difference between time and space. We don't know where one begins and the other stops. So that most of the arts we think of as being in time, and most of the arts we think of as being in space. Marcel Duchamp, for instance, began thinking of thinking of music as being not a time art, but a space art. And he made it a piece called Sculpture Musicale, which means...
So, Richard, Cage explored the various forms of silence, using these spoken discourse to delve into the essence of silence and how self-awareness helps in perceiving sound as an independent entity. What prompted you to select these texts, and how do you interpret the concept of silence?
So that particular recording, I had been watching interviews and things about John Cage. It's just sometimes you go down a rabbit hole and you decide to research an artist one week or go back to, you know, I had read the Silence book a while back, as well as the Noise, Water, Meat book, which spoke at length about John Cage, and just, you know, he has always been a favorite. And it was just an interview with him. He's talking candidly. He's in his New York apartment. You hear the traffic outside, and he's talking about how the traffic becomes the music.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I like the timbre in his voice, and I felt like this is something that, I don't know, maybe needed a score. And I just kind of had fun with it. And this track in particular is interesting because it's more of a kind of arpeggiated electronic type of thing, where I was using a sequencer and some synths, which was very kind of non-John Cage. So I felt like it was kind of a melding of these two worlds of the, you know, his experimental approach to silence and different things, and then kind of me taking more of a pop synthetic approach and combining the two and having them kind of talk to each other. I feel like there's an interesting conversation in the track between the sound composition and his speaking.
Yeah, it reminded me on one of other Cage's pieces, Comparative Indeterminacy. Mm-hmm. That's one of the revolutionary pieces where he was reading a text while Tudor was improvising.
Oh, nice. Uh-huh.
Anyway, let's get back to your piece that has that slow, deep, electronic, minimalistic sound with this beat and bass. Mm-hmm. And I know that Reich played a big role, an influential part, and especially his music for 18 musicians. And we have the similarity because that's one of the pieces that probably I would bring it to the island, abandoned.
Yeah,
island.
That's one of those. Yeah, that's one of those records, definitely. Yeah.
How do you find the connection between minimalism in, like, specifically Reich's music, or let's say Philip Glass, in connection to this, like, deep techno drone ambient sound genre?
So the power there is the repetition, and there's something that I got to understand more once I got into the music of Steve Reich and Philip Glass, and then going back to listening to techno, or like especially minimal techno. Mm-hmm. It has an effect on your brain. And it's this idea also too of the phasing technique, which Reich uses a lot, which is just something that does something to your brain that I'm interested in, that is just kind of almost a supernatural thing. And I feel like there's a lot of power in repetition and slight change over time. So, and that takes a lot of discipline, and that takes a lot of patience. Like, I couldn't imagine playing a piece like Music for 18 Musicians as a human, because it sounds like something electronic. It sounds like something that's has a metronome that is just a repetitive thing, but then phases. And that's, I guess, where the human element comes in, and that's what kind of creates that phasing technique. Thank you. So Reich has been a huge influence on me as far as, and then also too, even kind of just equating that to our daily lives. Our daily lives are these loops that we live over and over and over again. But there's these small little differences that kind of, you know, deviate our paths along the day, through the month, through the year. So I feel very much Reich's music is transcendent. It's transcendent.
Yeah.
And its power lies in the repetition and the just choice making, you know. It's simplistic in a way where you can understand it. Some people might think it's annoying.
You're right.
But you get to a certain, you know, especially in some Philip Glass pieces that could be a little difficult, or even Reich, yeah. Like, you know, his early tape works are really inspiring. When I first heard that, I was like, wow, he's just using a few tape machines, you know, and loops, and just the power of repetition. I feel that's what's the biggest inspiration to me.
We have listened to the track Phase 2 from the album Structures by today's guest Richard Verges, also known as Night Foundation. To find this piece, along with other tracks from the album, search for the label Noir Age on Bandcamp. And as I already mentioned, this album Structures is one of 60 albums released to date. Moving from that meditative field, like music for 18 musicians, to some other area, such as the noise and dystopian style of life, bringing Orson Welles and George Orwell, for example, his movie 1984 as a dystopian novel, or War of the Worlds, that was very, very popular and still well quoted today. Orson Welles, when he did the live broadcasted show.
Mm-hmm.
So moving to the song, to the track, Rumor, Fear and the Madness of Crowds.
Yes.
Tell me first, why did you choose such numerous references you wanted to highlight in creating this album with peace?
So that, it's funny, because I went back to that when you mentioned that, and I went back to that title. And that's a reference of a reference. I like the way that it sounded. I like the way when I first started making music, I was very much into, you know, looking at poetry, Garcia Lorca. So I was looking at just these phrasings and different titles. And that is a title of a book by author Chaplin, I believe is his last name. But I discovered, I haven't read the book, And I learned about the book through an artist named Monte Cazaza, who was a American artist. He was based in San Francisco in the early 80s, and he was very much involved in the industrial, post-industrial music scene and art scene. And I was reading, there's a book by the research company called The Industrial Handbook, and he references that book in his list of inspirational tools that inspired his work. And I don't know, I was looking for a song title, and it was the first piece of music that I had ever recorded. And I thought, I don't know, this sounds like what those words look like. And that became that track. And that's on that track, it's very crude. I think I was, it was a guitar through some distortion with tape loops and a synth, and just recorded.
How did you incorporate the guitar, the sound of the guitar and noise? Did you use a noise generator also to...
Delay. I've always, my biggest effects or my go-tos that I still use are reverb and delay, just because I feel, I like the...
Like analog ears.
So an analog delay and reverb pedal. I like the way that you can manipulate time and sound with those and kind of create this dream-like cinematic world with these effects. So it was just like, what do I have? What effects can I put it in? I've got this cheap mic and I'm going to set it up and I'm going to, you know, record to, I think I recorded that to a tape, and then I was able to then get that into digital on a Mac at that time.
I'm interested in touching upon a dystopian society just a little bit, because it's somehow related to this piece that we are going to hear. So dystopian, you know, I had to look at the dictionary because I'm familiar with utopian, but dystopian is like the opposite term that includes like complete control over the people in a society through the usage of propaganda, heavy censoring of information or denial of free thought. The complete loss of individuality. Julian Assange was freed yesterday. I mean, he actually left the prison finally, and I hope he's going home. You know, and I was thinking when I was preparing this question, I was thinking of him. What is your thought on the current society, and where are we leaning to in terms of dystopia as a phenomena? And the complete control propaganda in the United States and maybe the whole world that is living and going through.
It's very much a theme that I guess I was exposed to early on, through music, through industrial music, because it's very much a trope that is explored. This idea of, you know, us just kind of being cyborgs and being kind of slaves to a system, and, you know, everything's very compartmentalized, and we're just kind of, the media tells us what to buy, the media tells us what to think, the media tells us what to listen to. That's very much something that I take as fuel to create from. You know, it's not something, I guess, that I want to be proud of. You know, we all want to live in a utopian society, but the reality of it is that the world is a scary place. We are in a noir age. We are in a dark age, you know, and it's been coming for a while, since the days of 1984 and films like that. A film that I watched recently was the THX film, that was George Lucas's first film. And that was really interesting to see a film like that made in that time. And just that being a commentary visually and conceptually. So I feel like we're very much kind of as interesting as it is to watch those types of movies like a Blade Runner or 1984, the fact that we might actually be living in that world now is scary.
True.
One book that I go back to often is Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, where they're living in this future dystopian world where books are outlawed. And if you're caught with books, they need to burn the books. And it's just this kind of almost like absurdity, you know, this absurdity of how society could just be so ridiculous sometimes. And really, all we can do is, like I said, use that as fuel to create and let that inspire you and hopefully create something positive out of that.
Yeah. And share a message.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before we introduced our listeners to the last of your pieces you suggested for this show, I just want to remind our listeners not to forget to explore the latest selection of top albums I curated for the Soundologia platform. That's our quarterly list with some terrific releases from May to July 2024, where you will find some real gems to keep our followers happy. We will be providing redemption codes for the majority of the albums on the list, so stay tuned for more details. Richard, you already mentioned the collaboration with the choreographer and dancer Ana Mendez.
Yes.
On the project Laborers.
Yes.
So you can say something about it, because we are going to listen to the first track on that album. And I am also interested about the performance. Where was the performance held and what was its visual presentation like?
So the Laborers was a project that was funded by Miami-Dade, and it took place in the that performance theater that's there on the Miami-Dade campus. And just in the way that my working relationship has been with Anna for a while, where we very much sometimes don't even have to talk to each other, where we just kind of, we connect on an idea, you know, something visual that she might have in mind, and then it's something, you know, musical that then sprouts out of my mind. So Laborers, it was a performance about transformation inspired by creation mythology and space travel. Performance showcases the transmutation from one state of existence to another. So it has a very cosmic quality to it. And once again, it's something that I feel leaves it open for interpretation for the audience. So a lot of it is aesthetics, is pure movement. My wife Marcella also danced in the piece with another dancer named Jenny, and there was some tense moments, there were some very tender moments, and it was just kind of us trying to create this cinematic moment that people could kind of experience with the music and the lighting, and just kind of get something out of it, whether it's a nostalgic, there was a little bit of a nostalgia to it. Anna had just had a child, so there's some kind of maternal instincts to the piece as well. So, but once again, yeah, it was something on the more abstract side that, you know, we got to work on cinematography, we got to work on the sound design together and the movement together. And it's just always been a great organic process working with her.
In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness.
Last night, I had a weird dream. I was walking on a beach. My mother was there. I was worried that I would have seen it like a tsunami. Exactly like a tsunami. She kept digging and wouldn't listen. I had to leave her behind. What time did all this begin? Tonight. It's hard to say. We should bring them back. George is waiting outside. He's too big to fit into the small room. Maybe he can take her there.
A Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you. all of you on the good earth.
And I left this question that I could ask you earlier, because the whole label, the Noir Age, is focused on mostly publishing ambient drone sound. This genre has experienced a surge in popularity over the years. Its rise began with influential figures like Brian Eno and other composers and producers. Today, you can hear it in various settings, ranging from airports to hairdresser shops, the concert stages. So what are your thoughts on the future of the ambient music genre?
That's interesting, and that you mentioned that too, because I've very much seen a not a resurgence, but it's become popular for the first time in the world. I feel like ambient music is kind of popular. Mm-hmm. I think it had to do a little bit with 2020 and the pandemic. There was a time when people felt the need to look for peace, and they were finding peace in music and finding peace in meditation. So I think definitely the pandemic had a lot to do with this idea of slowing down as opposed to speeding up. I mean, with the power of the internet and demos and tutorials everywhere on YouTube, on Instagram, it's so easy now to just kind of discover new things like ambient music. So for somebody who might have just listened to pop music their whole life, and then finally they discover what's this kind of music that has no words, that makes me feel a certain way. I definitely think that cinematic music plays a part in that, as far as a lot of notable ambient musicians now who are scoring films, which I think is great. And that is definitely the direction that I want to keep going in, is to be doing more scores for films and working with film, because that was my purpose when I started making music, was to make music for imaginary films, because film music has always inspired me. So I think ambient music is at the forefront right now, just because people are just looking for new things. And this is very much a future of music. And ambient can be a difficult title, because you think of kind of maybe new age or yoga meditation, which that serves its purpose as well. But ambient music could also be scary. Ambient music could also be abrasive. Ambient music, you know, it's the sounds around us that we're listening to that, I guess, gets us to kind of take a step back and take a break and just be like, I can just walk outside and hear the sound of traffic, or hear the trees, or hear the wind. And that in itself is a form of music, is a form of sound organization that I feel resonates with people. And I think that's why people are listening more now to ambient music. And I think that's exciting. Some people I know are gatekeepers, and they're like, well, I was listening to this before anybody knew about this and that.
Yeah.
Which I'm all for, you know, doing your research and thoughtfully listening to music. But, you know, it takes a little while. And I think it's exciting that people are getting into ambient music.
Yeah, that's true. Let's now mention some of your upcoming projects. I know that you are going to do a live scoring to some of silent movies in September.
Yes, correct. So we are going to be scoring the films of Maya Deren. She was a Ukrainian filmmaker from the 40s and 50s, and experimental type film from that era, very surrealist type of films. Mm-hmm. The most exciting part about this is we are bringing down this Italian percussionist. Her name is Valentina Magaletti. And she is somebody who's just been one of the musicians I've been listening to. Like, she's involved in so many different projects, and she's just one of the most interesting musicians, composers at this moment, I feel, in the avant-garde scene. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a real just pleasure for me to share a venue with her, to share a space with her, and possibly collaborate with her as well. So that's happening in September.
Beautiful. We look forward to seeing these performances in September. Good luck with this project.
Thank you.
And you also, do you want to mention some past projects that you just did in June? You did some installation, right? Intermediate installation.
Yes. So that was the new phase of my work, and definitely what I want to be traveling towards sonically and visually. And it was an installation that I had from January that just closed now in June. And it was a total work for me of, mixing together projection, sound, performance, sculpture, collage. And it was basically a room where I had, you know, I presented this, and it was an immersive experience where you could walk in and experience that environment. And it was something that it developed over time. It started with just a TV and a flashlight on a turntable that made the flashlight revolve. And then that was reflected off mirrors. And I said, okay, that was kind of the starting off point. And then, well, let me hook up some cameras and let me live video that. And then project the live video, and then that in turn created these kind of feedback loops with between the projectors and the cameras. So it was very much an experimental process that culminated in just this, like I said, it felt like a total work for me. The piece was called The Light Pours Out of Me, and it was kind of this exploration of just the nostalgic kind of childhood playfulness using old technology. The focus was that there was no computers in the room, that everything was an analog piece, everything was a physical piece, and everything was kind of interacting and talking with each other and creating just different little happy accidents and different light leaks here and different sounds that triggered visuals. And so just a nice immersive intermedia experience that I want to do more of in the coming future.
Beautiful. I wish you the best of luck with all of your upcoming sound immersive installations and projects. And now I want to share the announcement that I mentioned earlier today, that we are giving away the whole album published on Noir Age. And this is the album Parallels, Richard created in collaboration with David Briske. So to download this album for free, please check the link in the episode description. I have a couple of favorite tracks on this album, and I played the majority of them today in the background during our conversation, so I know you will love them. Richard, I know this album holds a special place in your heart, so yes, please share a few notes on that.
So it's an important album in the catalog because, as I mentioned earlier, the first ever release for the label was my collaboration with him. So I felt it fitting to have it be the 60th release for the label, have it be another collaboration with the beginning of the label, you know, kind of going back to that and everything just kind of making sense for a milestone, which was the 60th release. So it's a combination of original compositions by him on side A of the first tape, new original compositions by just myself on the B side, and then the second cassette is a studio collaboration that we did around that time that we started the label back in 2017 that we recorded and just never did anything with. So I felt it fitting to package the two into a double cassette.
Yeah, so today's show is coming to an end. In this episode, you had the opportunity to listen to a conversation with Richard Verges. He provided insights into his creative process as a designer and performer and shared what it's like to run the label in his home studio production setup. His label is a real publishing laboratory called Noir Age, a welcoming space where artists from around the world can have their music published. To learn more about Soundologia and listen to our guests and previous shows, visit us at soundologia.com. There is a quarterly top list of best albums that I have curated for you, so you don't need to spend hours and hours on Bandcamp looking for some great releases. So I believe that you will find some gems there that you will be happy with. If you have any inquiries, feel free to contact me through our website or social media. Richard, thank you so much for being with us today. I thoroughly enjoyed speaking with you. I learned a lot. You were a great guest, super professional, responding to everything that I requested. So I know that we are gonna make some collaborations in the future, and I would love to maintain this long-term friendship.
Yes, I agree. Thank you, Pedja. Thank you for having me.